Mr. Alderson looked into the lifeless fireplace for a minute or two. Then he directed his gaze upwards at the oil painting of the paddling cars which hung above the mantelpiece. He pursed his lips as though about to whistle, but appeared to change his mind, and, without salutation, took a gulp of his whisky, which sent him into a paroxysm of coughing from which it took him some time to recover. When his breathing had returned to normal, he sat up straight and fixed me with streaming eyes. He cleared his throat, and I felt a certain tension.
"Aye, well," he said. "It's grand hay weather."
I agreed with him, and he looked round the kitchen with the interested stare of a total stranger. Having completed this inspection, he took another copious swallow from his glass, grimaced, closed his eyes, shook his head violently a few times, then leant forward.
"Mind you," he said, "a night's rain would do a lot of good."
I gave my opinion that it undoubtedly would, and the silence fell again. It lasted even longer this time, and my host kept drinking his whisky as though he was getting used to it. And I could see it was having a relaxing effect. The strained lines on his face were beginning to smooth out, and his eyes were losing their hunted look. Nothing more was said until he had replenished our glasses, balancing the amounts meticulously again. He took a sip at his second measure, then he looked down at the rug and spoke in a small voice.
"James," he said,
"I had a wife in 1,000. I was so surprised I hardly knew what to say. "Yes, I know," I murmured. "I've heard a lot about her." Mr. Alderson went on, still looking down, his voice full of gentle yearning.
"Yes.
She was the grandest lass for miles around, and the bonniest." He looked up at me suddenly with the ghost of a smile.
"Nobody thought you'd ever have a fella like me, you know."
"But you did." He paused and looked away.
"Aye, she did."
He began to tell me about his dead wife. He told me calmly, without self-pity, but with a wistful gratitude for the happiness he had known. And I discovered that Mr. Alderson was different from a lot of the farmers of his generation, because he said nothing about her being a good worker. So many of the women of those times seemed to be judged mainly on their working ability. And when I had first come to Derby, I had been shocked when I commiserated with a newly widowed old man. He had brushed a tear from his eye and said, "Aye, she was a grand worker." But Mr. Alderson said only that his wife had been beautiful, that she had been kind, and that he had loved her very much. He talked about Helen, too, about the things she'd said and done when she was a little girl, about how very like her mother she was in every way. He never said anything about me, but I had the feeling all the time that he meant it to concern me. And the very fact that he was talking so freely seemed a sign that the barriers were coming down. Actually, he was talking a little too freely. He was halfway down his third huge whiskey, and in my experience, Yorkshiremen just couldn't take the stuff. I had seen burly 10-pint men from the local pub keel over after a mere whiff at the amber fluid, and little Mr. Alderson hardly drank at all. I was getting worried. But there was nothing I could do, so I let him ramble on happily. He was lying right back in his chair now, completely at ease, his eyes alight with his memories gazing somewhere above my head. In fact, I am convinced he had forgotten I was there, because after one long passage he dropped his eyes, caught sight of me, and stared for a moment without recognition. When he did manage to place me, it seemed to remind him of his duties as a host. But as he reached again for the bottles, he caught sight of the clock on the wall.
"Well, dang it, it's 4 o'clock. We've been here long enough. It's hardly worth going to bed, but I suppose you'd better have an hour or two's sleep."
He chipped the last of the whiskey down his throat, jumped briskly to his feet, looked around him for a few moments in a businesslike sort of way, then pitched headfirst with a sickening clatter among the fire irons. Frozen with horror, I started forward to help the small figure scrabbling on the hearth. But I needn't have worried, because he bounced back to his feet in a second or two and looked me in the eyes as if nothing had happened. "Well, I'd better be off," I said. "Thanks for the drink." There was no point in staying longer, as I realized that the chances of Mr. Alderson saying, "Bless you, my son," or anything like that, were remote. but I had a comforting impression that all was going to be well. As I made my way to the door, the farmer made a creditable attempt to usher me out. But his direction was faulty and he tacked helplessly away from me across the kitchen floor before collapsing against the tall dresser. From under a row of willow-patterned dinner plates, his face looked at me with simple bewilderment. I hesitated, then turned back. "I'll just walk up the stairs with you, Mr. Alderson," I said in a matter-of-fact voice, and the little man made no resistance as I took his arm and guided him towards the door in the far corner. As we creaked our way upstairs, he stumbled and would have gone down again had I not grabbed him round the waist. As I caught him, he looked up at me and grunted, "Thanks, lad," and we grinned at each other for a moment before restarting the climb. I supported him across the landing to his bedroom door, and he stood hesitating as though about to say something. But finally he just nodded to me a couple of times before ducking inside. I waited outside the door, listening in some anxiety to the bumps and thumps from within. But I relaxed as a loud, tuneless humming came through the panels. Everything most certainly was going to be all right.